Welcome to Brighttown Broadcast News for Friday, December 22nd, 2023. Mike Adams here, and to start out, we have a big episode here today. We have an amazing interview coming up with David Dubine about global supply chain collapse and some new things that are happening with Malaysia and the Red Sea and the Israel situation and the Houthis and so on. We'll talk about all that in a minute, but I've got a poem to share with you first. This is a poem written about nature and gardening and seeds. And I wanted to share this with you. It's not very long. Let me just read it. And I want to know what you think. As pious nature doth bestow upon each tiny seed its life anew, a sprout emerges from the cold soil's clasp and grows to be a plant with verdant laps. The sun's warm rays aid in this rebirth. Nourishing roots, they take their first on earth. As tender shoots break through and intertwine with leaves that dance beneath the gentle skyline, a garden blooms, a sanctuary divine, where healing foods grow, where life is redefined. So, pretty interesting, especially given that that was written by a large language model AI system. That is one of the pilot projects I'm currently running on my desktop computer, and I simply asked it to write a poem about the miracle of healing foods and seeds and gardens in the tone that might resemble William Shakespeare, and that's what it churned out. Now, a lot of people don't realize what these large language models are capable of. Most people don't. And they are astonished to find out that that poem that you just heard, for example, it's not copied from anywhere. And the system was not trained on that poem or any similar poem. I mean, not really. That the system came up with that. So these systems, these large language model systems, and remember, I'm working on one that will be released free of charge. You'll be able to download it and run it on your local computer. End of March is the current release date that's planned. We're currently in the data curation and fine-tuning training stages for this. A lot of iterations yet to go. But once you have this tool in your hands, you'll be able to ask it to do all kinds of things. You'll be able to ask it to write a poem. You'll be able to ask it to write a business email or to summarize a paragraph or summarize a short book or a report or to extract information from things. You'll be able to tell it to act like William Shakespeare or to act like a comedian. You'll be able to ask it to translate from English to Spanish or Spanish to Italian or Italian to German or German to French or French back to English or any combination therein. Because this language model that we're releasing, it will speak English, French, German, Spanish, and Italian, by the way. I don't think it's going to speak Chinese, because that's not the base layer that we're using. There are language models that do speak Chinese quite well, actually, but that's not one that we are building upon. But I just want to give you a taste of what you're going to be able to experiment with yourself completely free of charge, completely offline. You'll be able to run it locally, and it won't cost you a dime. And no one will be able to spy on your queries or what you're asking it to do. And you'll be able to ask it all kinds of interesting questions and even things like, hey, give me an idea of, let's say, some things that I could do to more efficiently, I don't know, grow tomatoes, let's say. In fact, you know what? Let me enter that question into the system right now. Let's see what it says. So here's my query. I'm going to type it in real time. Let's see. Act like a master gardener and advise me on the, let's say, five best ideas to increase the yield of tomatoes in a home garden. And let's see. Providing accurate, truthful, and positive information. Okay, there we go. Let's see what it says. All right, here we go. It's already responding. Number one, ensure proper spacing between plants. Tomatoes require adequate space for healthy growth and fruit production. Plant them at least 36 inches apart. Blah, blah, blah. It goes on. Point number two, provide consistent watering. They need regular access to moisture, but not overly wet soil conditions. So, number three, use compost or aged manure as organic fertilizer. Composted materials provide essential nutrients like nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and so on. Number four, practice crop rotation. Rotate your garden beds every year to help prevent soil depletion from continuous cropping in one spot, and so on. Number five, protect against pests. Regularly inspect your tomato plants for signs of insect infestations, such as caterpillars and aphids. And then if you find problems, take appropriate action. It could include organic methods like neem oil or soap sprays, or resorting to chemical controls if necessary. And there you go. So do you have a question that you would love to ask a large language model system that we are training in order to be an expert in areas of gardening, food production, herbs, nutrition, you know, alternative and complementary medicine, natural medicine, self-reliance, all these things that matter? Well, you're going to have that tool. It's going to be in your hands. And the plan is, let's see, the last day of March. And I'm pretty confident we're going to be able to meet that date, by the way. So get ready, and thank you for all your support. In the meantime, because we've had to spend quite a lot of money on this project already, and a lot more expenditures will be coming, but this is going to be the world's best trained language model on those topics that I just mentioned, you know, nutrition, herbs, gardening, food production, phytonutrients, and applications of nutrients, including synthesized plant nutrients, as well as minerals, and a lot of things for emergency first aid and self-reliance, all that. I mean, you're going to have this tool. So it is your support at healthrangerstore.com, by the way, that allows us to be able to do these projects for humanity. And thanks to your support and the fact that we are so blessed by our customers and blessed by God with clarity for our mission and the resources to pursue it, then we're able to bring you this, and I can't wait to get it into your hands. Now, a couple of reminders of some other interesting things that are happening right now on decentralize.tv. That's the website that we have. You know, that's my show about decentralized living. If you go to decentralize.tv, you'll see we have some new episodes posted there. Just scroll down a little bit from the homepage, and you'll see we just posted an episode with Gene from Epic Cash, and that's our first official interview with the Epic Cash project. Although we did interview Todd Lewis, a couple months ago almost, about Mimblewimble, but this is our first interview about Epic Cash. And then a few days earlier, we posted an interview with Doug from Monero Talk. And I really, really encourage you, I mean, you need to know about Monero for starters, because I think that, number one, people, if they're starting out in crypto and trying to understand what all is going on, what it's all about, start with Bitcoin and then go to Monero. And then after you understand Bitcoin and Monero, then start getting into some of the more cutting edge privacy coins, which would include Beam, Firo, which is F-I-R-O, or Epic Cash, for example, or look at the Mimblewimble blockchain, or Xano, projects like that. But definitely listen to Doug with Monero Talk. And you need to know about Monero. You know how all these times I've said, you know, have gold and silver and land and ammo and privacy crypto. If you don't understand how Monero works and what it is, then consider that your Christmas homework assignment. You absolutely need to understand how to use Monero. And it's very easy to do so. Just go to the website, getmonero.org. Yeah, I think that's it. M-O-N-E-R-O, getmonero.org. Download their wallet. Install it. I mean, you've got Mac, Linux, and Windows versions there, and there's also mobile versions. Just install it and see if you have a friend that's got any Monero, and just ask them to send you like 0.00001 or whatever, so you can just see how it works, and then you send it back to them. I just want you to have literacy of using Monero wallets. Because, well, 2024 is about to get really interesting in terms of banking collapse, right? And asset confiscations, you know, the great taking, as we talked about the other day. And if you don't understand how crypto works, it's going to hurt your ability, I think, to be nimble or to respond to events that are taking shape in the world. I think everybody needs to be literate about gold and silver. And I've recently added gold backs to my, you know, bag of solutions in that area. I think everybody needs to understand crypto. You need to understand Bitcoin and also Monero, if not other coins. And if you don't have that base, you know, give yourself the gift of knowledge in those areas. And notice that I'm not saying to dump a bunch of money into it, you know, or to go crazy and speculate on. I'm not saying that at all. But if you want to buy Monero, the place to do that is Kraken.com, K-R-A-K-E-N. It is a KYC exchange, which means they have all these know your customer rules and you're going to have to prove who you are and provide all this documentation, everything, which is pretty much standard these days in the crypto exchanges. But I'm having a meeting coming up with a project that I think you'll find really interesting. I don't have all the details yet, so I'm not going to say who it is, but it's a project that allows, well, precious metals-backed crypto without requiring KYC. So I'll tell you more about that as I learn more, and if that goes well, we'll invite those folks on for an interview, and we'll see if we like it or not. I'm always going to ask critical questions, no matter who it is, and I'm always going to reinforce the idea of you being cautious and, you know, protecting your assets, but also avoiding risk. But right now, the greatest risk in my mind is keeping your money in the bank in dollars, because all that stuff, Dorothy, it's going bye-bye. That's kind of a line from The Matrix. Well, poorly restated, I should say. Okay, next thing happening is beginning December 30th. So just coming up in a little over a week. So a week from tomorrow, Saturday, December 30th, we are launching a new program on Brighton University called Personal Energy Preparedness. And that is a program created by Qigong master Francesco Garipoli. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I interviewed him. I'll be running the interview coming up maybe Sunday. I'm not sure exactly. But personal energy prepping, man, this is a really important area to gain knowledge. You'll be able to watch the entire series for free with just an email registration at Brighteon University, which is brightu.com. Oh, and that's just spelled bright and then the letter U, brightu.com. You can register, watch the whole series for free beginning December 30th, and it teaches you way beyond material preparedness. It's not about more Band-Aids, bullets, and beans. It's about preparing your mind, your heart, your soul, your courage, your dedication, your adaptability, your ability to overcome fear, all these things that matter in terms of preparedness, because it's about more than just having buckets of stuff. It's about understanding and expanding your capabilities of handling the rapidly changing circumstances in the world around you. And as I talked about yesterday, you know, domestic warfare is coming to the United States of America. Many cities in America will burn, no doubt, during 2024. There's no question whatsoever that this is coming. Probably both before and after the election is what I'm anticipating, even if we have the election, which I'm not even sure that that's going to take place. But we've got to be ready and resilient mentally and spiritually. And Francesco teaches that, and he's a really amazing man. Just an incredible spiritual leader. And I can't wait to play that interview for you as well. But anyway, just go to brightu.com. You can register for that course and mark your calendar to begin watching for free on Saturday, December 30th, with the option to, of course, you could purchase the whole course if you wish, and then you can download it and watch it on your own schedule, or you can watch it for free. And there's a new episode that plays each day. That's how that works. Okay. One more thing to mention. I normally wouldn't plug a sponsor this early in the program, but in the interest of time, the Satellite Phone Store, being that it's Friday right now, the Satellite Phone Store can still ship out phones today for Saturday delivery in most areas, and you can get a satellite phone literally in your hands tomorrow. But the satellite phone store will be closed during, I think, most of the Christmas week, if not all of it. So if you want a satellite phone before the end of the year, you need to call them today. Go to sat123.com. Go there. There's a phone number. You can give them a call. You just tell them, you know, you want to get a satellite phone for Saturday delivery, and they can arrange for that, again, in most areas. Perhaps not Alaska or Hawaii. I'm not sure. But you could ask them and check it out. sat123.com. And, you know, there's something interesting about satellite phones that I did want to mention. That did you know that in Hawaii, in Maui, only a small percentage of the island burned in those fires recently? It was something like 5% of the island was burning, or even less. But did you know that 95% of the island lost power and cell phone service? And even 911 was down because, you know, the state of Hawaii didn't have proper backups and so on. And right now that there are many areas in Hawaii that still don't have any cell towers. So if you were in the middle of an emergency and your house was on fire, or your neighbor's house was on fire, and you were trying to reach, you know, emergency services or maybe a family member, a satellite phone was the only way to do that. It was the only way to call for rescue, to give intel to firefighters, perhaps, or to let a loved one know that you're okay, or to check in on a loved one. Satellite phones serve that purpose. So think about it. With what's coming, it's good to always have the ability to make and receive calls via satellite, sat123.com. Now, a little update on yesterday's story. If you did not hear the interview from yesterday with our whistleblower known as Red Cell, you got to hear that interview. I've received a lot of feedback on it. People are really disturbed by what they heard. Sadly, there were some sleepless nights among some of our listeners yesterday, perhaps you, I hope not, but Red Cell was laying out the plan, or the actual operation of how Texas is transporting these hardened criminals and dropping them off in sanctuary cities like Chicago and Denver and Los Angeles and New York City. And that our contact, our whistleblower, Red Cell, he was one of the security guards, in essence, on these buses. So he made many of these trips himself. And because he's fluent in Espanol, he was able to overhear what these hardened Venezuelan prisoner criminals were saying and how they plan to run drugs at their destinations and commit felony crimes and all these other things. Well, a follow-up to that, today, this story came out in Breitbart, Texas begins migrant relocation flights to Chicago. All right, so I guess 23 busloads a day can't handle all the criminal Venezuelans that are coming across the border. So now Texas is chartering flights. Okay, here it is. Texas Governor Greg Abbott stepped up the process of moving migrants out of the state to sanctuary cities by starting migrant flights to Chicago. The escalation follows actions by the Chicago mayor, that's Johnson, to interfere with migrant buses sent from the Lone Star State. So a charter jet, get this, the state of Texas is actually like chartering jets, okay? A charter jet flew 120 immigrants, i.e., you know, Venezuelan drug gang, you know, criminals, from El Paso to Chicago on Tuesday, Governor Abbott revealed in a post on X. He said, quote, "Sanctuary City Chicago started obstructing and targeting our busing mission." So we're airdropping Venezuelan criminals into the middle of Chicago. Mm-hmm. The story goes on, says that Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson implemented a new city ordinance targeting migrant transportation buses that are dropping off without a permit or outside of approved hours. What approved hours? The ordinance includes a fine and the authority to impound or tow buses. Hey, we don't care. You can keep our stinky buses. Just take the criminals with them. In fact, we'll just drive the bus and just leave it with all the illegals on board, and we'll just walk away and get another bus. So the Chicago mayor told PBS that Governor Abbott was determined to, quote, create chaos throughout the entire country. That's dishonest. Actually, what Governor Abbott is committed to doing is sharing the chaos that the Democrats are imposing on Texas by opposing a border wall. I mean, what right do all these Democrats have all across America to place this burden on Texas and Arizona and New Mexico and California and to some extent even Florida and so on? I mean, these illegals are coming in because the Democrats are welcoming them. Joe Biden in particular. He's like, you know, come on up to Norte Americano or whatever, however he says that. And he's basically saying, come on in and we'll give you all these benefits. Well, guess what? We, the taxpayers in Texas, we have to carry that load. And that's not fair to Texans. And so I thought about this after my interview with Red Cell yesterday. I thought about this, about whether I oppose or support what Governor Abbott is doing. And I know that I've heard, for example, Michael Yon and Ann Vandersteel, who are doing excellent reporting on this topic, I've heard how much they strongly oppose what Governor Abbott is doing, saying that Abbott is, in essence, you know, distributing these criminals across America, effectively causing the migrant occupation of numerous cities across America. And some people have even accused Governor Abbott of being part of the World Economic Forum and its attempts to overthrow America from within. But I gotta say, on this particular point, the question of moving these illegals out of Texas and depositing them in sanctuary cities, I have to say, I actually agree with Governor Abbott on this. And I think we should ramp this up times 10. I think we should send buses, trains, planes, automobiles, parachutes, paragliders, whatever. I mean, if these migrants are okay with jumping out of airplanes with parachutes, airdrop these dudes right into Chicago. That's what I say. Flood the zone. Flood Chicago. I know those of you listening from Chicago, you're like, what? What did you just say? Hey, look, it's not that we want these migrants in America. It's that we want to show you how bad the problem is, because it's so easy for people in Chicago, like Mayor Johnson, to say, oh, that's not our problem. It's far away. It's down in El Paso. It's down in Texas. It's in Eagle Pass. It's not our problem. Well, guess what? We gonna make it your problem. You're gonna share in the problem. And why should Texas deal with all these criminals and all the law enforcement costs and surveillance costs, you know, security costs that goes along with it? Why should Texas cause its own citizens to be subjected to all the violent crime, the robberies, rapes, drug trafficking, and everything that goes along with these illegals crossing the border? I think we should ship them to New York City. Because didn't New York City say how proud it was to be a sanctuary city? Wasn't it New York City citing the Statue of Liberty? I forgot exactly what it says. You know, give us your tired, you know, you're sick, you're old, like bring them all in. Okay, how about felons and criminals and traffickers and former prisoners? How about them too? You want them? We've got plenty of them. We'll gladly airdrop them for you right there on Manhattan Island. How about that? And for Los Angeles, we should have landing craft, you know, landing on the beaches like D-Day, but just unloading like 10,000 Venezuelan criminals. Yeah. Welcome to the migrant problem, Los Angeles. What are you going to do with these guys now? Huh? Maybe you should support building a wall. Maybe you should understand why we have to protect the border. So actually, I find myself completely agreeing with Governor Abbott on this particular point. And I was even thinking, you know, Texas is kind of the middleman in this right now, these El Salvadorian or Venezuelan criminals, or I mean, they're also from other countries, sometimes Colombian or what have you, Bolivian even. They come in, they come to Texas, and then Texas sends them to LA. I was thinking, why don't we just bypass the middleman here? Why don't we have Texas send a charter flight to Caracas and just load up all the prisoners from, just empty all the prisons in Venezuela, put them on airplanes in Caracas, fly them directly to LA, drop them off there. Hey, guess what? The border is now your problem too. You see, I think we should take out the middleman. They don't even need to set foot in Texas. Just take them straight to Chicago, drop them off in Denver, Oh, you guys don't even like democracy in Colorado anymore. Guess what? You're going to see the consequences of that. Here, have 50,000, you know, hardened criminals with MS-13 tattoos all up their necks and teardrop tats, which have certain specific meanings and so on. Yeah, have fun with that one, huh? You should even just encourage them, all these illegals, to just go set up tents on the runways of the Denver International Airport, you know? Yeah, let's just turn the runways into tent cities, shut down the whole airport. Oh, yeah, oh, suddenly you have an economic problem in Denver, in Colorado? Your airport doesn't work? Oh, welcome to the club, because our border doesn't work in Texas, and it's because of people like you, Democrats, in places like Colorado and other, you know, blue states. That's why we have this problem. So you want to solve this problem? Support a border wall. It really is that simple. Otherwise, guess what? These people are just going to live on your runways or your highways or the grounds around your state capitol buildings or all your parks and your baseball diamonds and everything. Oh, you thought that was for kids to play baseball? No, now it's a migrant center. Huh? How about that? I'm all for it. Now, of course, I'm stating all this with a hint of sarcasm, because, of course, I'm not in favor of a migrant invasion of America, but I am in favor of waking people up to the severity of the problem. So I'm curious what you think about this. Is this a good thing that Texas is doing? You probably think so if you're in Texas, but if you're in Denver, you probably don't think so. I don't know. This is one of those NIMBY problems, right? Not in my backyard, NIMBY, the acronym. Well, Texas is my backyard, so I want to get rid of these felons, and what better place to send them than the blue Democrat-run sanctuary cities, which is exactly where they belong. And also, by the way, I mean, just a personal note, I'm not as afraid of, you know, Spanish-speaking migrants as probably the typical American, because, of course, I lived in South America. I speak a fair amount of Espanol, I mean, enough to get by. And I had many friends when I lived in Ecuador, many local friends, and converse with them exclusively in Spanish, of course. They didn't speak any English at all. And learned a lot about the culture, learned a lot about the people. And we donated clinic time to the locals there. We actually offered some traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture free services on Saturdays. The locals would come in and they would bring fruit. You know, like, here's papaya. And then we give them acupuncture treatment. We did some cool stuff. And we learned how to get along with local people in Ecuador. In fact, the only people that I had issues with in Ecuador were not the locals, but it was the other foreigners that were there that were doing crazy things. But I don't have any problem getting along with people who are ethnic, you know, Mexicans or Ecuadorians or even Venezuelans or what have you. And also, I know something that a lot of Americans don't know, which is that South Americans, Mexicans, and Central Americans are terrified of security dogs. Absolutely terrified. And you know why that is? Because south of the border, dogs get mean. And it's because of the way they're raised. So I have my security dog, as you know, Rhodey. He's hanging out with me. Where is he right now? He's sitting over there on a pillow. He's getting soft. He's got his own pillow now. But he's with me, you know, in my vehicle, when I'm shopping, in the studio, whatever. Latino men in particular will not mess with people who have security dogs because of their memories of mean, angry dogs in their home country, wherever they came from. Seriously. And those of you who are Latino hearing this, you're like, yeah, that's exactly right. Dogs are scary in Mexico or wherever, you know. El Salvador, those kinds of places. So anyway, but just saying, I get along with people of every ethnicity, by the way, and people from all over the world. And I'm not afraid. In fact, I would say that when qualified, a lot of Central and South Americans really make outstanding Americans as they immigrate legally, you see. And I encourage legal immigration. But when it comes to illegal immigration, that's obviously what we need to get a handle on. And one way to do that is to just keep shipping felons to blue cities until they wake the F up as to the extent of the problem here. In fact, just one more comment. There are a whole bunch of radical left-wing Americans that I would gladly trade for some good Mexicans. Seriously. I will definitely take some good Hondurans, some Bolivians, some Chileans, some Venezuelans in exchange for these radical left-wing fascist child-mutilating lunatics, none of whom would actually be welcome in South America, by the way. But if we could work some kind of a trade, I'd be all for it. You know how Hamas wants to get its prisoners back from Israel, and Israel wants its prisoners back from Hamas, and they're trying to work out a trade, some kind of a deal. And there's some kind of exchange rate, by the way. And for every like Israeli military leader that Hamas has, they'll probably get 1,000 prisoners released by Israel. And I'm wondering what the exchange rate is between like insane lunatic left-wing American libtards versus good, hardworking, Catholic, you know, family man Mexicans. Because I'll take the Mexicans any day over these lunatic libtards. You know why? You know why? Because the Mexicans, they don't mutilate their children's genitals, for one thing. I mean, just for starters, right there. The Latino families are pro-family. I mean, they're not trying to turn their kids into LGBT trophies to parade them around at parties. Oh, look, she's transitioning. And no, she's not. You cut off your baby's penis is what happened. That would not happen in Ecuador or Costa Rica or Mexico or any of these other places. No, it does not happen there. Anybody tries that stuff, you know what happens to them? And I'm not saying I advocate this in America or anywhere else, but child mutilators in places in South America, I mean, Colombia or Venezuela or even in Cuba, you mutilate children, the locals will freaking skin you alive. They will, I guess I'll go ahead and tell you, they will do this thing where they tie your hands behind your back, make you down on your knees in the middle of the street, and then they take used tires and they put tires around your torso, like stack them up to where you're looking like the Michelin man, and then they'll pour alcohol inside the tires and set that stack on fire. That's what they do to, you know, child predators in places like South America. Just saying, I'm not advocating for that, but that is, that's how much a lot of like Central and South Americans do not tolerate child predators. Just saying. And you know, before we get to today's big news, I'll get to it in a second, but there's something else I need to say. I would actually feel safer, much safer, living in many parts of Mexico compared to living in, I don't know, like Los Angeles or San Francisco, even in areas of Mexico, you know, controlled by drug cartels like Michoacan or wherever. And the reason is, here's what you got to understand about Mexican drug cartels, okay? Mexican drug cartels are business people, and they are part of the communities there. I mean, yes, they run drugs, or in some cases they do human trafficking, and that's obviously immoral. But if you don't interfere with their business, they're not going to do some crazy thing to try to hurt you or kill you. Even if they are immoral and carrying out what we would call criminal activity, you know, drug running, they're not insane. They're actually, believe it or not, very selfishly rational. They have a business plan. They are business professionals. And they trade in avocados too, by the way. The drug cartels also control the avocado trade, which is why avocados are so expensive. And of course, I buy a lot of avocados, so I guess indirectly, you know, they're benefiting from my grocery purchases as well. But that's all they're going to get from me, since I don't buy marijuana or fentanyl or whatever else they're pushing. I just buy avocados. That's expensive enough. But it is a rational operation that the drug cartels are actually running down there. I'm not trying to minimize how dangerous they can be if you're on their enemies list. But what I'm saying is, in America, leftists are so dangerously irrational that you can never be sure if you're safe, because you don't know what crazy thing they're going to do next. Whereas if you're living in Mexico, you know who the drug cartels are and you know the boundaries. You know what not to do. Like, you don't steal from them, for example. You don't steal their weed or steal their money or what have you. And as long as you understand the bounds, it's very clear what the rules are in many places in Mexico, whereas in liberal cities, nobody has any idea what the rules are. One day, they're just crapping all over the streets, you know. The next day, they're setting up migrant tent cities everywhere and kicking U.S. veterans out of the shelters. I mean, you have no idea what's going on. One day, you're not allowed to have a firearm for self-defense. The next day, you defend yourself in your own home, you get thrown in jail for defending yourself, which would never happen in Mexico, by the way, or even most other countries in Central or South America. Somebody breaks into your house in, let's say, Peru, and you defend yourself and kill that person in your defense, guess what? You're fine. Nobody in Peru, no government is going to prosecute you for killing somebody that broke into your house. It doesn't work that way. What the ethnic Latinos understand is that there's a universally accepted idea of basic self-defense, which does not exist in liberal cities right now. Which is one of the reasons, by the way, to circle back around, why the criminals from places like Venezuela want to go to blue cities. Because that's where the robberies are easiest. That's where they take the lowest risk of engaging somebody with firearms. They don't want to be in a firefight. You got to understand, these criminals from South America, they're coming to America and going to blue cities because that's where the easy pickings are. They know how to break into the homes and go to the master bedroom and get the jewelry, you know, and get the firearms or get the cash, whatever they can get their hands on, and get out of there. And then they fence that stuff. And they just made 1 year's annual salary in one night. You know, a salary compared to what they would earn back home. They can make it in one night in a place like Denver. And they know that the people of Denver, being these anti-gun libtards, won't defend themselves. And that they've defunded the police. You know, it's kind of like these blue cities are setting up a sign, like a big giant sign, like everything free, come here, rob us. You know, it's crazy. We're going to defund police. We're going to disarm the citizens. We're not going to prosecute illegals. I mean, gosh, what's not to like if you're an illegal, violent felon wanting to rob Americans and make a ton of money doing so? It's like the perfect storm. And that's what these blue cities are doing. They're practically advertising it. Whereas, you know, in Texas, totally different ballgame. Oh, you want to rob me in Texas? I hope you can dodge bullets. You know, that's the attitude in Texas, all over Texas, except maybe not Austin, Texas, which has turned into Libtard Central. But everywhere else in Texas, you know, the illegals, they don't run around breaking into people's homes, or if they do, they don't have a very good life expectancy, it turns out. They don't do that. Word gets out. They're like, oh, we should have gone to Chicago. We should have done this in New York City. Nobody shoots back in New York City. We should have done this in LA. So much easier there. So much less risk. They're doing the calculations, understand? So if you want to be safe as an American, let's say listening to this, you need to get to a red county in a red state where even everybody else looking from the rest of the world is saying, like, I don't want to rob anybody in that county because those people are heavily armed. Yeah, exactly. All right, shifting gears here. Let's talk about the news out of Malaysia. So, of course, you know the situation with Israel and Gaza, and Israel continues its outrageously illegal and anti-human bombing campaign of Gaza, killing now tens of thousands of civilians who are not Hamas, while Israel claims that this is self-defense. We're defending ourselves by dropping, you know, 50,000 tons of bombs on apartment buildings and hospitals and refugee camps and so on. And this continues to this day. It's unbelievable. I mean, this is straight up ethnic cleansing. Some people call it genocide, and it's hard to argue with that. And Malaysia has now not only banned Israeli-flagged ships from docking at any of its ports, but also it won't allow any ship to dock if it has any cargo that is going to or from Israel. In other words, Israel can no longer ship any cargo on any, you know, ocean vessel that expects to have to dock in any of the ports near Malaysia or at Malaysia. And because those are really important shipping waters around Malaysia and Singapore and, you know, the whole peninsula there, this is another pretty big deal. So note also that, of course, six of the largest ocean transport carriers have now banned their ships from going through the Red Sea, which is, of course, en route to the Suez Canal to get to the Mediterranean. And that's because of the Yemeni rebels, the Houthis, as they're called, that are firing short-range rockets and using drones to attack some of the cargo vessels there. And as we've covered recently, the insurance companies pulled their insurance for these vessels, and then these shipping giants said, well, without insurance, we can't run ships through the Red Sea. So these giant cargo ships are having to divert around the southern tip of the continent of Africa, going into some very rough waters, by the way. A lot more treacherous conditions there, with all this cargo on board being subjected to, you know, more temperature variations and humidity variations and also rough seas and things like that. It's tearing up the cargo. And it takes an extra 2 to 3 weeks to do that. So now the supply chain globally is taking a big hit, not only because of the Houthis, but now also because of Malaysia. And here's the question. You know, Malaysia is about, what, almost two-thirds Muslim, I believe? Wonderful people in Malaysia, by the way. Beautiful people. The time that I was in Malaysia, I had a fantastic visit. I was in Kuala Lumpur, you know, KL, which I'm pretty sure that's the capital of Malaysia. And I loved visiting Malaysia. Great people. But again, about two-thirds Muslim. And they don't want to just sit there and watch Israel just commit genocide against the Palestinian people, who are mostly Muslim, but not all. There are plenty of Christian Palestinians as well, and Christian Gazans, and there are Catholics there, and so on. So there's been a lot of pressure from the Malaysian people to force the Malaysian government to target Israel's shipping lanes or shipping infrastructure. And that's exactly what just happened. So the prime minister of Malaysia, and this is quoted in Al Jazeera, says, quote, that Israel's actions violate international law through the ongoing massacre and brutality against Palestinians. So the Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim announces this decision. He's going to impose a maritime ban on all Israel-affiliated vessels, specifically targeting ZIM, Z-I-M, which is the largest shipping firm out of Israel. And ships on their way to Israel, says the story, will also be barred from loading cargo at any port in Malaysia, effective immediately. Now, there's also rumor that Indonesia may join this action and also ban Israeli vessels, because Indonesia is also, of course, primarily a Muslim-populated country. And in case you're not recalling the geography of the region, Malaysia and Indonesia, they sit at the gateway between, Southeast Asia, you know, China, Vietnam, and all the way to Taiwan and Japan and so on, and including the Philippines. The gateway between those countries to the Indian Ocean and the Middle East. So the ships that are transporting goods from Asia, you know, exporting things, let's say, from China or from Vietnam or South Korea or Taiwan or wherever, those ships traverse through the waters, the South China Sea, getting to Malaysia and Indonesia, and they often stop there. They often stop at the ports. I don't know if they need to refuel there. I doubt it, but they do stop to load and unload containers, because sometimes, you know, containers are only going to Malaysia. Well, and then Thailand is right there, and Cambodia, and of course Singapore there at the tip, the southern tip of or just south of Malaysia. So this is going to have a huge impact, actually, on trade between the Middle East, including Israel, and Southeast Asia. It's going to cause another disruption on top of the disruption of the Red Sea, which is already in place because of the Houthis attacking the ships there. So the question is then, you know, what kind of extra steps and extra costs do these ships have to go through now to traverse the waters that are becoming increasingly dangerous, and now fewer ports are available to them, which matters not only for logistics and refueling and so on, but also in cases of storms. You know, if a storm is approaching in a certain direction, or if there's some kind of ocean event, you might need to anchor off a port near Malaysia. You might need to traverse a certain area. And as Israel continues its bombing campaign of civilians in Gaza, you can imagine that these Muslim-dominated countries are just going to become more and more assertive in blocking off anything associated with Israel, which is really quite understandable, because Israel is carrying out these horrific crimes against humanity. And if you're a country that has a lot of Muslims, why on earth would you want to support Israel that is murdering your brothers and sisters, so to speak, in Gaza? And I know I'm not saying all Muslims are brothers and sisters, and there's so many different religions and different ways of practicing Islam and so on, but there's still a general idea of sharing fate. And when Muslim countries see the horrific actions being taken by Israel, or in particular the Zionist globalists that are currently in charge of Israel, who are some of the most evil people on the planet. Netanyahu is, I mean, he's going to, when he goes to hell, he'll be right beside, you know, Stalin and Adolf Hitler and a bunch of other people like that, you know, burning for eternity for his crimes against humanity, no doubt. But modern day, present day Malaysia doesn't want to help enable Israel to support its economy or to support its trade, which would ultimately support its war on Gaza. So that's where this is coming from. By the way, the horrors of what's going on in Israel really came to light here in a story that was on commondreams.org. The title, Cashing In on Genocide, Israeli Firm Pitches Beachfront Real Estate in Leveled Gaza. So they're actually advertising property development on the beachfront of Gaza. And they say, quote, "A house on the beach is not a dream." This is an advertisement from a company that builds in the occupied West Bank, according to this article. Palestine defenders this week condemned a proposal by an Israeli real estate developer specializing in the construction of illegal settlements to build beachfront homes for Jewish colonists over the bombed-out ruins of Gaza. I'm reading from the article. Now, you know, obviously, some of that language is, you know, from the point of view of Palestine. Quote, "A house on the beach is not a dream." It drew international attention following last week's practical preparation for Gaza settlement conference in Tel Aviv. There's an ad that depicts an artist's rendering of luxury homes superimposed over an actual photograph of a Gaza neighborhood destroyed by Israeli bombs, which have killed nearly 20,000 people. So I want to show you this photo, which is being called, of course, ethnic cleansing. And this is some sick profiteering right on top of the graves of bombed out women and children in Gaza. So you see that? They've sketched these like luxury beachfront apartments like right on top of all the bombed out Gaza buildings. I mean, if you ever wondered why Israel was carpet bombing Gaza and using bulldozers to clear it out, it's because they want the real estate, folks. And also they want the real estate because they want the energy that is associated with Gaza right offshore. And they probably want to build the Ben-Gurion Canal so that they don't depend on the Suez Canal. Yeah, I mean, this is some sick stuff. I mean, they probably still haven't even found all the dead children yet. There's probably children buried under the rubble in this photo. And an Israeli real estate developer is sitting there saying, "Oh yeah, you can have luxury, you know, beachfront apartments. As soon as we scrape off all of the Palestinian dead bodies, you can build there." Isn't that wonderful? Because that's the way a lot of Israelis think about Palestinians, that you should just bomb them and kill them and replace them and build your place and boom, now it's Israel, greater Israel. I mean, this is some sick, twisted, anti-human stuff going on here. And by the way, any of you listening, if you are a Christian Zionist and you think, oh, God, you know, gave these people the right to do all this, you're sick, man. This is so anti-Christian, anti-God, this so contradicts the teachings of Christ. You can't be a supporter of modern day Israeli Zionism and be a Christian. They're contradictory. You can't believe both at the same time. It's impossible. Don't be deceived. Bombing women and children is not Christ-like. And God did not grant Israel some divine power to rule over all other human beings and mass murder, you know, a billion Arabs to expand Israel to cover most of Saudi Arabia and Iraq and, you know, Jordan and Syria and Lebanon, of course. And no, come on. It drives me bonkers when people quote the Bible to condone genocide. Like, do you hear yourself? You say you follow Christ and you support bombing women and children who aren't even combatants? What's wrong with you? So there's a group out there called Jewish Voice for Peace that tweeted about this. It says, quote, "Just as the Israeli government was crystal clear in its plans to commit genocide, the Israeli government's post-genocide colonization strategy is explicit and blatant and a war crime. We can stop this. Don't look away. All eyes on Palestine." So you know how earlier in today's broadcast, I asked my local language model to write a poem about gardening and sprouting foods and the joys of seeds, the miracle of seeds and all that. And I asked it to write the poem in the voice of William Shakespeare. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to ask, you know, since we're talking about Gaza and Israel and Palestine, I'm going to ask this language model to write a poem about the situation in Israel and Palestine and Gaza and civilians and the bloodshed. I'm going to ask the language model to write that poem right now. So let's do that. All right, that took less than a minute. I just paused it. Here's the poem written by the language model. "In Gaza's land of sorrow, where death doth reign, Israel's hand does writ in blood with cruelty unchained. The genocide intentions clear, colonization plan exposed. A war crime they dare to show that we must not ignore or close. Their cries for help unheard, their lives at stake, as Israel's cruel hand does claim more innocent lives to make. But we must not look away nor let this horror be, for if we do, we too become complicit in crimes against humanity. Let justice reign and peace prevail. Let truth be our guide. And in these crimes that doth defy all moral bounds of pride, let us stand together in solidarity for justice and peace to reign, and let the world be free from such atrocities as these again." So there you go. Can you believe that that poem was just written by artificial intelligence? Kind of moving, isn't it? Kind of moving. Yeah, think about that one. Think about that. Think about the fact that an AI computer program understands more about life than does Netanyahu and the Israeli Zionists and many Christian Zionists in America. Think about that. A computer has more understanding of life than the Zionists. That's astonishing. It really makes you wonder, doesn't it, about the future of our world, the future of the human race, when so many members of the human race have lost their minds and abandoned their hearts and surrendered their souls, but a machine can make more sense than a prime minister or a Supreme Court justice from Colorado or a school teacher in San Francisco. I mean, what does this mean about the future of our world? I will leave you to ponder that. And of course, we'll talk about this more in upcoming episodes. We're going to jump into the interview here with David Dubine, Adapt 2030. But I also do want to mention, well, first of all, you know, Merry Christmas, by the way, for those of you who celebrate the Christmas holiday. That's coming Monday, and I do plan to have a Christmas message for you, perhaps on Monday or maybe the day before, maybe Christmas Eve. It's not clear to me yet which day or what message I'll put out there, but I will have updates for you, okay? And I'm not doing any interviews next week. But I've already done so many interviews that I will have interviews for you most of the days next week. So if you're looking for, you know, some good content and to be well informed, be sure to check out my channels at brighteon.com and also, of course, naturalnews.com all week next week. Maybe not on Christmas Day, but beginning the next day, Tuesday through Friday and even the weekend. I'm going to be working on more of my AI data science project next week. I'm having to shore up on all kinds of tools, like just basic Python code and some data structuring and some database queries, and I'm honing some skills on prompt engineering as well, which is how you interact with large language models. And I'm also doing a lot of data curation. We're getting a lot of people who are sending us data sources to be considered for training these language models. And I want to thank you if you've sent something to us. My staff is actually compiling a full list. A lot of people have sent us a lot of files or downloads and PDFs and books and transcripts and things. And they will all be considered for being included in the training of this language model that we'll be giving away for free, kind of open source freeware. And if you would like to contribute to that, if you've got a book, some science papers, you know, transcripts, you know, something that, I mean, you need to have the rights to it, by the way. You can't just take somebody else's book. But if you've got content, it could be a compilation of articles, and you would like to contribute that to our project, then please send us a link to the following email address. Now, it's just a link where we can download it. You know, you should upload it to someplace like Dropbox or, you know, WeTransfer or whatever. I mean, don't send us a giant 50 megabyte attachment to an email, please. That doesn't really work. But send us a link of where we can download it. And you can send that to situationupdate@protonmail.com. Again, situationupdate@protonmail.com. I can't guarantee you that what you submit will be included, but I can guarantee you that we will review it. And if we believe that it is, number one, accurate, honest, and aligned with the mission of our language model, then we will include it. And we will thank you for participating. This is becoming more and more of a community project. And we're just doing the, you know, we have the hardware and the GPUs and the know-how and the engineering and, you know, all the technical know-how to get all this done. But it's, the knowledge is coming from the whole community. People like you listening to this. So we appreciate your input, your support, and I can't wait to get this in your hands. You're going to absolutely love it. It's now, what, 100 days away, something like that. 100 days away, you'll have this in your hands. And you'll be able to ask it to do all kinds of things, like write poems if you want. You can have it write poems about Donald Trump if you wish, called Orange Man Good or whatever you want. It's up to you. Use it however you want. But as a research tool, you know, experimental research tool. All right. With that said, enjoy the interview here with David Dubine. It's an eye-opener. You're really going to learn a lot. And I'll be back with you with an update sometime this weekend. So take care. Welcome to this emergency broadcast on Brighteon.com, which is one of the most censored free speech platforms in the world. And you're about to find out why, because my guest today is David Dubine, who is, of course, an expert in global food supply chains and the dynamics of weather systems affecting food and human survival and even cultural survival around the world, and so much more. His channel is called Adapt 2030. He joins me today to talk about world events and with some surprises that will shock you. Welcome, David. It's great to have you back on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And, you know, we're coming into the solstice in just about 2.5 hours here for the Eastern Standard Time solstice. So, you know, go into it with a smile on your face, knowing that this is a change of energies, not only for the planet, for our minds as well, and how we can utilize this, knowing that we're at the low point of, you know, energy for an entire year, and we're going to be swinging out of that. And to kind of mentally harness that every day you can also bring more power into your own life instead of just like holding on to a piece of string in a hurricane as the global events sweep past us, and they're meant to instill fear. But for me, I'm trying to harness that and be like, are you going to push me this much this way? I'm going to push twice as hard a different direction, because I don't want to have that control over me. And if everybody could start to think a little like, You know, breathe that air, give the smile. That's what they hate. They hate laughter. They hate you using your mind and your energy to break free of that programming and create your own reality in life. And this is such a perfect time to talk about it with the winter solstice right here, just an hour or so after our talk. It's truly going to be mind over matter as we move through this next year. And, yeah, you know, as I've been talking about with the planetary alignment coming up in October of 2024 with the square that hasn't been seen since 79 AD, seems like the world's on a timeline. And I mean, the push is vast, it's all encompassing, and there's nowhere to escape from it right now.
Yeah, exactly. I want to talk about also what's coming in 2024, in your view, what we're looking at, because it seems like so many events are aligning to shape 2024 to be the most difficult year of our lifetimes, probably. And, you know, in so many ways. But how about this? Let's start with what's happening in the Red Sea with the six largest shipping container companies on the planet now banning all transport through the Red Sea, which means the Suez Canal also, because of course the Houthi rebel attacks on the cargo ships. This is stemming from Israel's continued bombing of Palestinians in Gaza, which is angering the Yemeni people, causing these attacks on the ships. I mean, it's all interrelated, folks. But David, talk to us about what this means for global supply chains of food and fertilizer and anything related to being able to sustain our lives day to day, even in the West.
That's where a vast amount of control comes in. And you've heard, you know, these power brokers through the ages talk about having food to control the masses. You know, controlling a world economy is one thing, but controlling food to then control the people is something on a whole different level. So think about all these things and they're interplaying. Are you telling me really that naval forces just let the Yemenis continue to escalate and escalate and escalate without getting there, although they had forces there to stop Somali pirates back in the day, that nobody lifted a finger after the first or second incident? And they let it go on for weeks and weeks, and now, oh, now we got to, it's almost as if it was done on purpose to allow it to run to that apex where they knew that would be the outcome. Huh. That insurers would stop insuring vessels, and it would guarantee they ran around the Cape of Good Hope. Right. Yeah, there goes your global warming right there. You know, is anybody from the Fortune 500s that's supporting all the green agendas going to suddenly, you know, shut their mouths for a minute because they need to run an extra 2 weeks of dirty bunker fuel around a bottom part of our planet so they can continue to sell their trinkets of junk? But the thing is, coming into the planting season, you know, an enormous amount of companies, individuals, farmers, co-ops are getting ready to get their implements, their repair parts, the things they might need for fertilizers inbound right now in the supply chain to get ready for the planting season. This is going to delay it or disrupt it completely. So you got to think about how much food can be disrupted. Not only the ability to get things into the farmers' hands to grow it in the fields, but then for that processing to take that to a factory and then put it in whatever, a box, a bottle, plastic container, and then ship that elsewhere. I mean, you're talking about multiple delays on multiple fronts, all just revolving around food. And then what's that? The second largest of electronics componentry part maker on the planet says they're looking at a 40-week delay now.
Oh, so Schneider? You're talking about Schneider?
If it's not engineered component part that you're doing something specialty, but if it's just right off the shelf, 20 weeks, if you need something done that would be specific for you, it's 40 weeks.
Well, let me interrupt right there for a second.
There's a lot of components. So you'd know more about it in the farming industry because you have some tractors. Like, what kind of electronics are involved in the modern tractor that if that 20 or 40 week delay on parts, how's that going to affect machinery in the fields?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're dead in the water. I mean, a modern tractor is a very high-tech instrument, much more high-tech than an automobile typically. And these tractors have a lot of sensors. And the sensors, they're programmed to shut down if the sensor senses a problem with, for example, the emissions control system. So, you know, a lot of these tractors have a diesel emission fluid, right, DEF. I mean, I think almost all of them at this point because they're all diesel. And if your DEF sensor goes bad, it might be a $25 part, but your $200,000 tractor is offline for 6 months because that part can't be sourced. And that has happened to people. We've actually covered that before. But that's an example of it.
because the government's forced the tractor manufacturers to make sure the engine won't run without DEF in there. And again, if the sensor breaks, the tractor thinks you don't have any. So we're talking about very highly vulnerable, highly complex systems that rely on these complex supply chains, which relies on the U.S. Navy to secure the safety of these shipping routes, and the Navy can't do it, as the Houthi rebels are proving. All it takes is a few thousand dollars worth of drones and a couple of low-tech rockets, and you shut down half the global supply chain right there.
And I saw there's a Twitter channel called Iran Observer, and they were pointing out yesterday that now Malaysia is putting out the word that anything that's to or from Israel-bound cargo ship, anything, even if you have one container heading to Israel on your ship and 99.999% is even going somewhere else, even one container on one ship heading that they can find on a manifest that they're no longer allowed to transit through Malaysian waters or dock or port berth in Malaysia.
Wow. I did not
know
that.
Yeah, that's a huge one too. Now, if Indonesia does a thing, I was looking at some maps. I got some maritime, interoperable maps there. So if Indonesia decides to do the same thing, they're going to overlap on territorial waters a little bit south and to the east of Singapore, which means there would be no transit route.
Wow.
None. See, and if Indonesia follows the same scheme, then that blocks off the Malacca Strait completely for anything in or outbound from Israel at that point.
Right. See, that's okay. What you're talking about is extraordinary because, I mean, the entire global system of food and consumer goods and textiles and electronics is based on a highly efficient, reliable ocean transit, the entire system. I mean, this is why you have, you know, food that's grown or produced in America, like chicken meat, and it's shipped to China for processing, and then it's shipped back to America for retailing. I mean, how could that be? Well, it's because of the efficiency of these ocean supply lines. And that's vanishing. And David, I'm sure you're watching this. The congregation of U.S. naval vessels in the Red Sea, in the Mediterranean, in the Persian Gulf, for God's sake, sailing right by Iran through the Strait of Hormuz, almost like begging, you know, nuke us or bomb us. It's almost begging to try to provoke a war. Well, what does this do about then China and Taiwan, right? How can the Navy defend Taiwan if all the Navy is in the freaking Red Sea? I mean, do the math.
Depends on how engaged China wants to be to go after the island.
Yeah. Well, what do you think?
And then
think
what is that? You know, Tinian, they're going back over to dust off a few of the old air bases in Tinian to put out a second ring off there, you know, from Guam down to the Marianas there. So look for the U.S. Navy and also our Air Force. The refurbishing the runways. I saw the CBs were out there cutting a bunch of new roads around Tinian. And just there's some amazing archaeological artifacts there on Tinian that don't make sense, like megaliths, seriously large megaliths. And then also the air bases. You know, it'd only have to extend the runways a little while. I didn't realize that the size of the runways that they put there in the 1940s or can accommodate almost every one of the aircraft we have now, except for like the long range B-52 bombers or something. But, you know, are we going to re-inhabiting? You got that first ring there with Taiwan and the Philippines and Japan, and then you got the second ring of defense there in the Marianas and Guam all the way down to Tinian. And then it's almost as if we're starting to retake the islands again as in World War II. What's next? Guadalcanal? Are we going to set up something there to try to prevent?
Yeah, but you can't dominate.
All about the ocean transit and that movement of goods across through the islands. And if you can control those different rings of island heading in and out of, you know, the Asian coast there, then, right, you know, the same thing happens. So whatever country controls it will then be able to dictate the economy of at least that part of the world.
You've nailed it. Exactly right there. Whatever country controls those sea lanes will be able to dictate exports and imports, which means manufacturing and domestic GDP. So China, of course, is asserting its naval power with massive infrastructure of the construction of naval vessels. According to a recent report, China actually has 200 times more dry dock capacity than does the United States. It is astonishing, 200 times greater. And they are churning out all these naval vessels, and they intend to completely dominate that area of the world, those waters. And you can't control that with air power alone. I mean, you're talking about the runways for air power, but as you know, air power alone can't control the waters. Only a Navy can control the waters, and the U.S. Navy is probably going to get itself, you know, nuked or attacked over in the Middle East. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at this point, David, if we lose an aircraft carrier. I'm serious. It's almost like the Pentagon is begging Iran to sink an aircraft carrier.
Yeah, there's one of those four over there now that is stationed to go into decommission 5 years from now anyway. I forget which one it is, but that would be, if I was just guessing, saying, you know, optimal loss for most involvement into the conflict. You know, it's going to dry dock anyway. They're going to spend how many billions, because how much toxic removal will be required for hazmat teams to get in there and remove an enormous amount of whatever. Just, you know, let one of those Sunburn or Onyx missiles run into it. And that would be another way to draw a huge amount of Americans' support for an intervention over there. Because almost everybody I know, doesn't matter where they sit, they're like, that's a very bad idea to get bogged down now with Iran. You know, the oil's going to go up in price. Everything's already expensive, going to get more expensive. I mean, that's just like Charlie Foxtrot times 10 to get in there and do that on purpose. But if a carrier gets sunk and all the boys died and, you know, something is probably going to stick out of the ocean a little bit, because I think it's only a couple hundred feet deep running through some of the channels there, but our carriers are 1,000 feet long. So can you imagine that? It would probably be some kind of war memorial as well. It'd be sticking out of the sea, rally around the thing there. And you just wonder how much of it's on purpose, because I'm absolutely saying that those attacks on the merchant vessels were allowed to continue unabated, untested, unchecked to get us to this point. And now, is it all about control of the food supply? Because I really bring it back to, okay, oil's one thing, economy's another. But if you can absolutely dominate and control the world's food supply, the movement of it, the sale of it, who gets it, who doesn't get it, I mean, that's one of the most powerful plays if you're looking at a global chessboard, is food control for the world populace.
Yeah. Well, I would say, I mean, the two big things there are food and energy, right? So as you mentioned, oil, but also natural gas exports. And right now with the Suez Canal essentially being, you know, largely blocked, you have to wonder about energy exports to Europe that are coming out of places like, you know, Qatar, right? And how much liquid natural gas is actually transported through there, through the Strait of Hormuz. I think it's something like 30% of all the exports in the world go through the Strait of Hormuz. And you're right. I feel this is starting to feel to me like Pearl Harbor, where the U.S. military allowed the attack on Pearl Harbor. They knew it was going to happen. They almost sort of, you know, begged for it. They provoked it. And they made sure that key ships were not in the harbor, but the ones that got destroyed were the ones that needed a lot of repairs anyway, or that were close to being decommissioned, right? And then, of course, a few thousand U.S. servicemen and women were killed at Pearl Harbor. And so the American people got behind the whole war in the Pacific, which before that did not have American support. This feels exactly the same to me. This is a modern day Pearl Harbor to get the American people to support war with Iran. And this is all about expanding Israel to greater Israel, which you've seen the maps. They want to take over half of Saudi Arabia, most of Iraq, you know, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, probably part of Egypt by the time we're done with this. I mean, Israel wants to control the energy and the water. We haven't talked about water yet, but the greater Israel map is about 40% of all the water resources in the Middle East, by the way. And that, as you know, has everything to do with food and agriculture. So what are your thoughts on everything I just said right there?
They need to toss in the wild card, the new Renaissance Dam. And I was just reading Sudan and Eritrea, Ethiopia, they couldn't agree on the electricity distribution or the irrigation distribution that was coming off of that. Because in addition to the new Renaissance Dam, they have a step down coming off the plateau there of three more large dams. They're not going to be as large as the new Renaissance Dam, but very large in comparison to continue to generate electricity. So that'll be a hub for new manufacturing in Africa when this new, you know, era of history begins. We're in the reset now.
Hold on.
So
where is this dam itself? Where would this dam be constructed? The new Renaissance Dam.
It's already
dam.
Been constructed. It's the largest hydroelectric dam in Africa right now. It was supposed to take 7 years to fill, but it filled in 2 years. So somebody knew the hydrological patterns were going to change in advance.
Okay, but
this is in Ethiopia right now.
Oh, that's in Ethiopia. Okay. All right. Sorry. I was not familiar with that dam. But I want our audience to understand the implications, you know, geographically of what you're talking about. So it
Now who in their right mind would build the largest hydroelectric dam in Africa in one of the driest places in Africa? Unless you knew the shift was on in the West African monsoon or something on a multi-thousand year cycle that was going to green the Sahel again. Uh-huh. And water resources come in two forms in Africa. We got the below ground water resources, which would include the Nubian sandstone aquifer and the Sousse aquifer out along in Morocco. And look at all the aquifers that go through the Sahel region. If you were going to couple the below ground water resources with the above ground precipitation increases due to this shift on a multi-thousand year cycle, we're talking about a new food growing zone.
Right.
And also with the new hydro dams there, you have all the electricity you need now to bring Africa into and become a world leader in manufacturing, processing, et cetera, because you would have stable power. And that's the whole thing about the countries up in the Northeast couldn't agree on how much power was delivered because everybody wants that power. Uh-huh. To have reliable power means you have a reliable economy, and they can see it too. Whoever has, there's no low power, wealthy economies. Let's say if you're looking at a scatter graph somewhere, none, zero right, on the right. planet.
No, you have to have power. But I want to get back to this. So you're talking about a climate shift in terms of increased rainfall in that region. But what about the Middle East? What does the same projection show about increased rainfall in areas, you know, like Jordan or Syria or Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, over the last few years, you'll start to see that they are getting much greener. And you can go to a NASA Earth Viewer and take a look at previous years and see the vegetation index on how that's changing across the area. But if I could take you back in time to circa 800 AD, if we go into Yemen, there was an area there called the Marib Dam, M-A-R-I-B, and it was the largest freshwater reservoir in the entire Middle East. That was in 800 AD. So, you know, these precipitation patterns come and go. And all the frankincense trees that were grown there on the frankincense route for have those massive, massive 100 square miles of frankincense trees growing in what is now bone dry desert. That shift occurred quite quickly. There, it was pretty much drying out within a couple hundred years on that shift. So if we're heading back into it, and then it could be a more rapid shift in the onset period, then this becomes very, very valuable real estate for a lot of agriculture and energy both. Because again, controlling the world, you need the food and you need the oil or the energy. Now imagine if you, in the reset, the great reset they keep talking about, is consolidating food production centers areas into one. So that way we don't have to worry about all these global conflicts. We don't have to worry about regional conflicts. If we, the great leaders of the WEF, can bottle everything into one area on the planet and grow all the world's food in just one single area, and then we can distribute it for you, and we can take back all the farmland and turn it back into forests. And this, I think, has something to do with the plan. I don't have all the information, but it seems like it fits in.
Global central control over the food supply also. So all of humanity becomes enslaved and subject to the terms of food distribution.
That's it. You know, and I both talked to Andy Shechtman, and you know, that rails, they have definitely completed a new rail section going through Kazakhstan right now. So their rail routes from China through Kazakhstan all the way over into Russia has just jumped up a level plus. So yeah, you can start to see how, you know, there's different control networks that are being disassembled across the necessity for sea lanes now. But who can control the food in that new greater Israel area that you were talking about? Imagine if it was a food growing zone as well as an oil export area combined into one. Like, what kind of power and wealth could that generate for those areas?
Well, this really shows
to restructure and reset up a new economy. The new fourth turning begins in Africa this time.
Wow. Okay. So Israel is clearly desperate to carpet bomb Gaza, to take Gaza, and of course, his offshore discoveries of a massive amount of natural gas and other energy resources. It's also believed that the proposed Ben-Gurion Canal, which would connect the Red Sea to the Mediterranean through Israel, that and it goes right through Gaza, the plan does, and so they need to take Gaza in order to build that canal. That would free up Israel from having to depend on the Suez Canal controlled by Egyptians, and the Egyptians have to be bribed with billions of dollars a year from the U.S. and other countries in order to remain kind of neutral. So the Ben-Gurion Canal would give Israel a lot of tactical advantages in terms of access to the sea lanes. But and then you mentioned the railways that being constructed, Belt and Road Initiative from China. But as you know, David, transport is about 100 times more expensive on land than it is by sea. And so the sea lanes are the most critical channels for nations to be able to achieve economic growth, which translates into military power and, you know, geopolitical power. The sea lanes are where it's the most important of all. So if Israel, I mean, if this Red Sea doesn't get opened back up, then we're talking about, you know, the crushing of economies of nations all over the world, basically a global impoverishment because of the lack of transportability and efficiency in transport. And then what you just mentioned about Malaysia, and I think you said Indonesia as well, is
not yet Indonesia, possibly. They follow the same track as Malaysia did.
So, I mean, this looks to me like we're going to have the fragmentation of the globe.
Blame the bankers, Mike. Don't blame the bankers and their bad policies and the never-ending money printing and trillions of dollars this to fund our debt. That's not going to be the culprit for the collapse. The culprit will be those people over in the Middle East. See, they caused it. Again, finger right. point over there. Don't look at our own, you know, mismanagement here.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But and then at the same time, as you know, in Europe, they're shutting down farms and farmland is being purchased by globalists in the United States. And there's this push on, you know, especially in the Netherlands and in Ireland and places to eliminate all ranching, all meat products. And so, it's obvious. They're trying to take Europe and say, you're not allowed to produce food in Europe because producing food produces greenhouse gases, they say, or nitrogen in the case of, you know, like cow urine. And then now they're saying nitrogen is bad. So instead, you're going to be beholden to this globalist plan and we'll produce food somewhere in Africa and then we'll give it to you if we like you, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and 2 points on that. So Egypt now has very little revenue coming through transit fees. So they got them by the neck where Egypt didn't want to play ball and let all the refugees in to, you know, resettle in the Sinai Peninsula because they're like, we don't need to, we have the money. Oh, now they don't. So if they're going to start defaulting on things, perhaps that'll be part of the pro quo is we'll pay off your debt, but you still have to take the refugees in because they got them by the neck now without those transit fees that they relied on so heavily. Yeah. They're going to put the economy of Egypt into the grave with King Tut. And that's the whole thing about. But if you're going to tell me with a straight face that you're stopping farming because of like an extra gram of nitrogen in the soil, yet these corporate 500 companies are going to run a vessel 3,500 miles around a bottom of a continent in some of the roughest seas on the planet.
Right.
Then they need to stop all discussion of global warming or all the shipping stops. Like you can't have it both ways here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like you and I won't be allowed to drive a car outside our 15-minute city, but they can burn, like you said, dirty bunker fuel in these ships around the southern tip of Africa, taking an extra 2 to 3 weeks of just burning fuel constantly in order to get their trinkets and goods to, you know, the UK from wherever, from India or wherever. I mean, but like I said, it seems to me like this whole thing, you know, the post-World War II era of U.S. naval dominance of the seas, which established the safety of these ocean lanes, like that's coming to an end, which means that all of the world's economies are going to have to be recalibrated to this. It actually means more localization of economies, which means you lose those price efficiencies. And so everything's going to become more expensive. So like if food inflation, if you thought it was bad already, or if you thought vehicle prices were bad, just wait. It's going to get a whole lot worse as we lose this international trade. But, you know, we'll be forced to become more domestically self-reliant, which is what Russia has done since all the economic sanctions were placed on Russia. So, and actually Russia's economy is now thriving because of that. So maybe there's a silver lining to this. What do you think?
Maybe Russia was a test case to see how quickly a country could pivot if they were cut off from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Because just one thing, I've done a couple videos on rationing in World War II and what were the first things that were rationed and how much of a ration unit would you get? If we do go into a global scenario here where there are wars, you know, food is going to be greatly rationed along with sugar, coffee, rubber, shoes, bicycles, cars. You're going to get a gamut of things. And they're going to move you over the digital rationing card to kind of fast track you into a digital ID. But once that rationing stops, perhaps they're going to leave you at a certain limit. That's all you ever get. Because control over a person, if you start with the food, I really believe in a huge amount of the factors we're seeing are related to food, because then they come into my wheelhouse of study where I'm looking at the electromagnetic anomaly coming up here somewhere in the middle of October of 2023 or 2024, excuse me, next year. Not really a lot is known on the effects of what the same planetary alignment had occurred in 79 AD. Now, we know Vesuvius went off and we know there was a lot of relocation of populace around there, a lot of coinage of the time changed, a lot of different boundaries of what were then empires had changed right around that 30-year period. So something significant occurred, even at that time when everybody was incredibly self-sufficient. So what brings us up to a magnetic anomaly? Well, if you're going to look at this and have the world distracted as we go into something that would disrupt daily life anyway, maybe it's higher tides coming in a few days before and after the event. You know, maybe the tide will be 3, 4, 5 times higher and taller than it normally is, just for a few days in and a few days out of the event. But how would that wreck coastal shipping? It would take us a decade or more to clean up from that. And there's something going on here far more than just what we're being led down the news path with. There's a greater event in motion that there's a timeline against, all predicated on the sun. And we're stepping off the sun. Now, anybody who wants to do the research, I encourage you. After we're at solar maximum now, and as we come into this solar minimum off this cycle, we are heading into a grand solar minimum. Whether you can look at the NASA, European Space Agency, any of the astrophysicists, Pokhovo Observatory in Russia, by the way, and it all has the same information. We're heading into a 400-year low at the minimum of solar activity as we step off of this solar cycle. Well, one of the biggest things affected is agricultural production.
Yeah.
So for me, with all these things about the scattering of agricultural production, trying to set up new grow zones and then explaining away why we don't have enough food already because of wars, instead of pointing to the natural cycles of the sun, because they want to keep this global warming tax moving forward, that it's the nitrogen. Now I see these ridiculous articles coming out of the UK talking about the human breath has 0.1% of carbon dioxide and methane, and you fart and you burp, and now they're blaming the human for at least 0.1% of all greenhouse gases emitted. You know, now it's gone into the bizarro land. But something is going on far greater, and the only thing I can ping it back to is this cycle we're about to roll into, electromagnetic disruptions, and then the sun stepping down into a 400-year low solar activity that would disrupt global agriculture to the point where we need to move our grow zones anywhere 45 degrees north on the planet, down. Anything 45 north and above, it will go offline, or very, very minimal production compared to today.
Well, you're describing all of Western Europe right there.
Yeah, so restructure the world based on those agricultural losses alone. Then the restructuring makes a lot more sense of what's happening right now.
Right. I mean, Europe is being gutted economically and agriculturally and culturally as well. But I mean, what about Canada? We got to talk about that. Hold on a second. Let me mention that you have a channel on Brighteon.com. It's called Adapt 2030. I'm showing it on my screen here, Adapt 2030. And then you also have a Patreon page, or how can people find your work or support your work other than Brighteon?
Yeah, moving over to Patreon, Adapt 2030, and Subscribestar, Adapt 2030. The YouTube presence is shrinking because of YouTube's algorithms. And I want to continue to get the information out, because it is about us having these discussions to find the answers, because those of our ancestors and forefathers 400 years ago, when they had to move to find better economic viability, or their crops didn't grow and they had to move to different places, it took a lot of solutions, and there was not just one solution. I talk about the problem with some possible solutions, but there's got to be 100 other solutions I've never thought of, or others haven't either, until we start the discussion. And that's the whole thing. If we can start the discussion and come together with some solutions, the movement from point A to point B through these changes that we haven't seen in centuries will be far easier. And it'll give far less control to the controllers who want to control every single aspect of this movement forward. If we have the knowledge of why it's happening, perhaps we can find our own way through this and bring others along with us on the journey. It's about helping everybody.
The governments and the science establishment and the media, they never talk about the sun's effects on climate. You know, it's always about climate change. As you said, they're blaming humans now. If you respirate, you're part of the problem, they say. Or if you eat meat, you're part of the problem. And it's very clear that there's never going to be an honest discussion about this, because the honest discussion takes power away from these governments that are basically bludgeoning the populations of the world with this climate change cult-like narrative that's rooted in complete delusion, fairy tales, you know, not reality. So, I mean, frankly, only the kind of people who watch this show or alternative media-minded people are even going to be aware of the sun's impact on climate and what's coming, the changes that are coming. I mean, most of the world's population are oblivious to this, all by design.
You know, say one thing now. Have you noticed that Corona whole stream came by a few weeks ago and the whole news stream of the world kept pointing to it like, oh, there's a hole in the sun as big as 60 Earths. It created a lot of earthquakes that day, and they kept referencing again and again, it's going to take down the internet. It could take down the internet for weeks. Oh, it might take out a power grid. Okay, the sun's that powerful. It's going to rip through power grids and disable our internet, but it can't affect a cloud system or a jet stream.
Good like, point.
You know, they try to give this mixed message, and that was all during COP28. Oh, the world's heating up, but wait, the sun's causing earthquakes and going to disrupt everything. But don't look at the sun, because COP28, and I'll pay your global tax, but it'll still interrupt the internet and the power grids. And I'm like, wait a second here.
Yeah. No, it's all a clown show. Even this whole idea of, well, frankly, COP28, I mean, remember, the host nation, the president of the COP28 event this year, he went up there and said, there's no proof, you know, that CO2 is causing climate change. And you know, people's heads exploded. But that's exactly what needs to be said. We need more CO2 to produce more food, right?
And he spoke very smartly about that, too, is if we're going to replace the energy generation systems, okay, what's your plan moving out? And nobody had a very definitive plan. They just have these pipe dreams of, we're going to reach this many gigawatts. Okay, well, when you reduce this much fossil fuel, you're going to reduce this many megawatt hours of electricity produced, which means this many goods and services produced. But they had no one-to-one, you know, plug-in, fill-in-the-gap correlation. So he was just straight up calling them non-planners. You don't even have a plan for all these things you want to implement. You have no plan for replacement. And that's really what got him vilified more than saying that CO2 wasn't really directly. He was like, your whole thing's a pipe dream. You have no plan for the replacement. And that's when they really took off after him. And I think there was something there that was more true than they wanted to let out about the whole scheme of this green energy utopia.
Well, and I think they don't have a plan for this transition, because their real plan is mass extermination of the human race. I mean, that's why they don't need a plan. They don't need to replace the power infrastructure of the world. They just don't plan for very many humans to be around to even need the power. I mean, that's their plan. Their real plan, I think, is extermination. It's clear to me that that's their plan.
And those that are left, they're going to want to have you tracked, traced, and rationed. So they're getting you soft beaten into this already, so you start to see that these changes in the world, and if we come into the global war, and then, you know, they're going to slow track you into getting used to this. Now, will it happen in a single year? Probably not. But over the rest of, you know, my lifetime and yours, for sure, they're going to try to pull it 100% together. And it depends on how quickly they can integrate AI into this. And really, the last thing is, you know, how much are humans willing to go along with it? Because if everybody says no, it simply stops. So it depends really on the human input into the planning and the systems, because enough pushback and no, it stops. But currently, with the incredible machine that they have to tweak the mind to manifest something of resistance is futile. I mean, I give them credit for that. The mind machine in this advertising and like behemoth of media has done a lot of preconditioning it to, it's already set in stone. There's no way it's not going through. But they forget the last little sentence, unless you say no. And that's, you know, we all have the chance to say no and really put a stop to this, but it takes a global awakening to all say no. And when we do, it simply stops. You look through history, everything that was deemed correct in society, acceptable in society, until it wasn't, when enough people said, no, it stopped on a dime and it never looked back. You could probably list 10 or 15 of the things in just a few minutes looking through, you know, the internet there, of things that just instantly stopped when society said enough.
Well, do you think that that backlash is going to have enough power to stop the climate cult insanity? Because I see a lot of evidence. I mean, yes, there are more and more people waking up, but there are also people that are unbelievably brainwashed. And even in the scientific community, of course, they all believe now in mainstream science that carbon dioxide is a pollutant. They've abandoned the understanding of photosynthesis. Just like in mainstream medicine, they've abandoned all ideas that you have an immune system. They've just erased it from the history of medicine. You don't have an immune system anymore. We give you an immune system with this jab, but you're not born with one. And that's why we have to jab you immediately right after birth, because otherwise you wouldn't have an immune system. I mean, it's a complete Orwellian, you know, mind wipe operation that's going on. And the vast majority of the masses, they fall for it on all these issues: climate, vaccines, transgenderism, which is a complete delusional fairy tale that you can take a child and change its gender by cutting off its genitals. I mean, that's insane. We're talking about a completely insane mainstream population, at least in the West. What do you think?
I think they've tipped their hand of being too insane on a few of the policies by now blaming the human for breathing. At that point, you know, and the thing that at least woke another 5% of the world up was this whole solar storm is going to wipe out the planet. And then they're saying, well, the sun has no effect on anything at the COP28. That was a very powerful awakening period for a lot of people. Were sort of on the fence, and they weren't. It just snapped them out of that. They can't have both. Like, come on, they're blowing smoke now to put all these articles out. And I'm just wondering at what kind of diehard percentage of holdouts will it be compared to those that awake? Because I'm always looking at these percentages. You know, at what percent of the population is that enough to make the pendulum swing over and absolutely stop the madness? Is it 5, 10%, 20%? Does it have to be 50? At what point of what world's population wakes up where the entire system at that point grinds to a halt of this global tax, these carbon credits, the carbon offset credits, underground sequestration credits? You know, it's all a different price point for each type of sequestration that you're doing, including what you're going to get. Is your family going to get a credit if you self-euthanize in Canada because you remove that 0.1% from your breath for X amount of years, and that'll be tacked onto their social credit score as a plus? Because your daughter or son euthanized themselves because they thought they were destroying the planet. So your family gets an extra square foot in the house each.
But you make a good point. I mean, this is a suicide cult. I mean, the whole climate cult system is a suicide cult. I mean, what you're saying is probably very accurate. They want people to kill themselves in the name of Gaia. You know, and they're probably going to give you rewards for doing so, or killing family members, or euthanizing infants, which is legal in Canada, by the way. There are all kinds of babies that are euthanized. And of course, you know, murdering babies is also legal in blue states all across America. So this is a suicide cult. And I don't think that these people will ever come out of it, because they're so completely brainwashed. It's become their identity of who they are, that they want to remove all carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which would, of course, exterminate all life on our planet. But they openly call for that. They love that. I mean, carbon sequestration, if you were trying to conquer some enemy planet in some science fiction, you know, colonial drama, you would go to that planet and you would install giant machines that would suck all the carbon dioxide out of their atmosphere and kill all their citizens. Well, they're doing that on Earth now, to us, on purpose, and they're saying it's good. It's like an alien invasion.
I didn't want to go there, but that terraforming aspect of it really fits in. I mean, that the reduction of carbon for human life forms, taking it down to the extinction level, but perhaps a different species that would thrive in a very much lower carbon dioxide environment might find that the most Goldilocks zone planet to live in. Just saying, man. Yep. You brought it up first.
Well, but also oxygen is going to drop because, you know, you're losing photosynthesis, so you're not getting the oxygen production from all the plants. So imagine an atmosphere that's almost all nitrogen. I mean, it's just inert. It's just in, there's almost no oxygen, no carbon dioxide, maybe a little bit of argon and nitrogen, and that's it. Well, how can any, I mean, insects can't even live without oxygen. Plants can't live without CO2. I mean, it's a dead planet at that point. It's dead. It's an ice ball dead planet.
Yeah, speaking of planets, another thing where you can see there's some sort of electromagnetic changes happening in the solar system right now. The clouds on Uranus, there's some huge anomalies up there. And also the James Webb Telescope just took a bunch of images of our different planets from Saturn, Neptune, Uranus, but they're all glowing more brightly. That's a whole thing too. Like, why are the planets more luminous? Like, what's causing a luminosity change across the planets? So far, it's not at Mars where it's growing or glowing brighter. But something definitely is happening, and that you got to take a look at the James Webb Telescope this day, these last 2 days of the releases of these three different planets that they're showing you. And the whole thing is about how much brighter and how much more visibly luminous they are in the headlines. So again, like, what's the pre-programming that they're giving us here that our planets are glowing brighter? And we got better pictures of them with different rings, and now the moons are very visible. So what is it that they're trying to signal for us to look at out there with the planets? Because if you're going to talk about global warming, then it has to be a different trigger causing those planets to change, because we're not up there with factories. No humans are up there driving around their SUVs. So to cause planetary changes on that scale, it has to be something that with our sun itself. And then you can really see the power of the sun and why all the ancient cultures in the world would always revere the sun, study the sun, and even some would worship the sun. But why yes. was it? Why were they so focused on it? When today we don't even look at, oh, I put on sunscreen.
Right, because the sun is the primary driver of, well, not just climate, but agriculture and the rise and fall of civilizations throughout human history. David,
I think we're at that. I really think we're at the apex, or something significant is coming, and they are racing the solar time clock to either position themselves, a continuity of government planning, to ride through this and then maybe make it out with the most amount of resources on the backside of this. But whatever's coming, there is a lot of movement in this particular year. And I really think it's going to speed up in 24 as they're rolling into something to get. I really think the gates are getting wheeled up in 24. I really feel with my research and thing at the end of 24, with this electromagnetic disturbance or anomaly, whatever you like to term it as, that they're racing against. That might be the beginning point of it, or it might just be a little event in itself that they're racing against. Either one, it's going to be an interesting year. And I know you've had quite a few guests on talking about, you know, predictions through 2024. So like in your landscape, what are you seeing in terms of like the rapidness of the changes and the largest changes that would be occurring through 2024?
Well,
based on the last, you know, couple months of guests you've been talking to.
Mark Zuckerberg has his massive underground bunker that's gone mm-hmm. public. Now, I was told about that, you know, months ago, but I couldn't go public with it. Now it's all over the news that he has this massive underground bunker in Hawaii. So, and he's not the only one. Here's the real answer to that question, David. The wealthy tech gurus and globalists are all building underground bunkers because they believe, whether we believe it or not, they believe that the surface of the earth will be uninhabitable or unsurvivable for some period of time, perhaps due to just social chaos, war, radiation, who knows? But they believe they're going to have to live underground for years. And if these are the wealthiest people on the planet, they have access to information that many of us don't have access to. You have to ask the question, what are they aware of that's coming, that's imminent, that they're not telling us? Why would Mark Zuckerberg want to live in a deep underground bunker that costs $70 million to build? And what are the rest of us supposed to do if you don't have $70 million to build a deep underground bunker? Well, I guess we're about to find out.
Somebody always knows something. So the information's out there. It's just trying to decipher it. And my timeline still rests. October 2024 is what the timeline they're racing against in the beginning of it.
Okay.
And tomorrow's show on Brighteon TV from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I'm actually going to be talking about that. And subsequently, when the Earth spins around the other side, or we have the four gas giants in a perfect square behind us, the sun behind us. And then as the Earth swings out in front directly in a line in April of 2025, we should get quite a bit more space debris, rocks, just, you know, space rocks coming in and hitting the surface of our planet for about 5 to 6 months. Then as we spin around on the backside of the sun, that should alleviate a little bit. So we, you know, we'll get a couple years of a heavy space debris bombardment coming in based on the geometry of the four gas giants in their square. So that's going to create magnetic effects that, you know, everything in the same quadrant of the solar system. I mean, you just, it's been quite some time since that's happened. You know, again, I would say go back to 79 AD and look prior and after 50 years and really see the changes in history and the monetary resets that occurred during those times as well. And, you know, if it's even parallel or some similarities to that time period, that very well may be why a lot of these people are bugging out right now. A lot of CEOs and C-class aficionados and leaders of companies are just bailing all this year, the most retirements ever. And then the moneyed class is all disappearing all in unison.
Yep.
What's going on? They're not going to wait to the last minute before they're going to make sure in case they forgot something at the castle, they're going to be able to still run back and get it.
Exactly. All right, David, we're going to have to wrap this up because we're out of time. But let me mention, your channels are called Adapt 2030. You've got a channel on Brighteon.com. You've also got a show with us on Fridays on Brighteon.tv.
2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
There you go. And then you've got your Patreon. And anything else you want to mention?
No, the Mini Ice Age Conversations podcast, where I try to do 30 minutes at a go. You know, because podcasts are really important for people who are, you know, cooking or going to work or working out. You can still listen to some valuable information. And I try to keep it relevant with the people I talk to also. We're really looking for solutions to some of these problems we've encountered through history. And we're just going to have, you know, nothing new under the sun, literally. So the same solutions might work again. We just need to discuss them to put them in action.
Yeah, good point. All right. Well, thank you, David. This has been a fascinating discussion.
Today, great talk.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. We appreciate you. Take care now.
Bye.
All right. And thank all of you for watching here. Of course, this is Brighteon.com, the uncensored free speech platform. And be sure to tell people about Brighteon. You can't do it on Facebook. You're not allowed. You can't do it on Twitter. You're not allowed. But you can type in Brighteon space dot D-O-T space com. You know, you can do it that way. You just can't put a URL in there. So you can still spread the word and help people, you know, join us for these conversations. What you just learned from David Dubine here is groundbreaking information. Everybody needs to know about this. The globalists are building bunkers. They know the surface of the earth is going to be unsurvivable for some period of time. What aren't they telling us? Well, if you care about your family, friends, and neighbors, you might want to alert them to this because something big is coming, and it looks like it's going to happen in 2024. Thank you for watching today. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com. Be safe, get prepared, and take care. All right, back in stock at the Health Ranger store, we now have our certified organic lab-tested milk powder and also our coconut milk products. Again, both back in stock. I've got some on my desk. Can you show that? There we go. We've got milk powder in number 10 cans, which are really great for long-term storage, also completely rodent-proof there. We also have milk, that is cow's milk, in the pouches, and then we have coconut milk powder as well for those of you who want that option. I use both of these. These are great long-term storable items, great barter items. They're both available at healthrangerstore.com along with hundreds of other products that we have there. Check this out. We also have our new organic super anthocyanins powder, which is great. I mean, this is a blend of 6 organic berry and vegetable powders. It's high in anthocyanins, which are the purple pigment molecules that have extraordinary properties for supporting your health. Also, of course, lab tested for glyphosate and heavy metals and more. And then if you go through the website, you'll see all these other products that we have. Freeze-dried beet juice powder, organic nascent atomic iodine that's in organic glycerin, by the way. It makes it more tasty for people. Here's our organic vanilla bean powder, like the real vanilla bean powder, not make-believe fantasy artificial vanilla flavors. And then we have this new Hydrate Elementals, which is organic coconut water with aquamin, which is a very popular mineral supplement. And this has great benefits. You can read about that and much more, collagen peptides and so on. All of this at healthrangerstore.com, where we do more in-house lab testing of our own products than any company in the world, any retailer, you know, any e-commerce company on the planet. We do more rigorous testing with our in-house lab, and that way we can bring you clean foods and supplements, things that we know to be clean, and almost everything certified organic as well. So check it all out, and thank you for your support at healthrangerstore.com. Take care.